Welcome to the We Know Show. I'm your host, Renate Stralifer, creator of We Are Not Sam. Take a deep dive with me as I chat with global visionaries in conversations that uncover inconvenient truths, but also shine a light on how to be healthy, safe, and human in a technology-obsessed world. Let's get started. Welcome to the We Know Show. I'm your host, Renate Stralifer, and my guest for you today is Charles Eisenstein. I'm super excited to have him on the show. And as I said to him before we record, I said this is a real bucket list moment for me. So I'm going to start off by doing an introduction and then we're going to jump straight into it. So Charles Eisenstein is an American author and public speaker who examines the unspoken narratives that direct our society and our lives. His work covers a wide range of topics, including the history of human civilization, economics, spirituality, and the ecology movement. Key themes explored include anti-consumerism, interdependence, and how myth and narrative influence culture. Eisenstein graduated from Yale University with a degree in mathematics and philosophy. He lived in Taiwan for 9 years, where he became fluent in Mandarin Chinese and worked as a translator. He married there, had children, and later returned to the United States. The Ascent of Humanity, which was published in 2007, became his first commercially successful book, launching his writing career. Charles has since written many books, including The More Beautiful World, Our Hearts Know Is Possible, and Sacred Economics. His newest book, The Coronation, was released in the summer of 2022. I'm super, I don't even know what the word is. Excited is probably not the right word, but it's close enough to have you on the show, Charles. And I can't wait to show our audiences what's possible when we really tap into those deeper inner knowing places, inner being places of our existence. So welcome to the show, Charles Eisenstein.
Yeah, thank you, Renate. I'm happy to be here with you.
So maybe as a start, you can give us a little bit of a background in how you've been sort of traveling these last few years.
That's a question I ask myself sometimes. How have I been traveling these last few years? Yeah, it's been, I think just as anyone who is sensitive to what's happening in the world, I've had a lot of ups and downs as I grapple with and metabolize what's happening in the world. So, how I actually do that, sometimes I myself don't know, but I've become aware that it's not, staying like, so I got an email from somebody recently saying, I admire so much how you stay so centered and grounded and peaceful. And, how do you do that? And I'm like, it's not that I can do that, but it's because I'm held in a community that together can do that. Where when one of us can't quite hold that vibration, the others can hold that one in the vibration of this emerging consciousness, so that we don't always have to be on game all the time. And so I guess that's in the last few years, I've been more and more aware of that.
Oh yeah, absolutely agree. And maybe one of the things that you cover, which I think is such a beautiful understanding, is the interbeing that underpins all your writing. Could you give us a bit more of an insight for those that don't know about the interbeing?
Yeah, that's kind of the unifying thread of everything that I write about. It's that basically I'm looking at current events, at human psychology, at pretty much everything through the lens of a transition in our stories or a transition in our mythology, from a story of separation, which says that who you are is a separate individual in a world of other, in competition all the time with each other and the rest of life, and seeking to exercise control over an indifferent or hostile universe. And that's what progress is, separation from nature, transcendence, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I call the old story. and transitioning from that to a story of interbeing, which is a word popularized by Thich Nhat Hanh. It goes farther than just interdependence, where we might be separate selves depending on each other practically, but it's that we're actually interexistent, that relationship defines who we are, relationship to each other, relationship to the world. So that from that place, we know that what happens to the world is actually happening to us in some way, and that our well-being can never come through dominating and controlling endlessly, because the beings that we dominate and control mirror parts of ourselves. So the jailer is always in some way incarcerated himself, and that we cannot thrive on a planet that is dying when the other life on this planet is not thriving. Then it's not that we'll die, it's not that we'll go extinct as a species, but something in us dies when we're not, you know, like, I mean, this happens to me all the time. Just if I'm doing a lot of work, a lot of writing, I'm on my computer a lot, I'm doing a lot of calls, and I'm not connecting with the rest of life, the material world, my view becomes warped. I enter this kind of prison where I'm not fully myself. And I can try to like analyze it and figure out what's wrong with me and stuff, and come up with all these ideas. And then I'll just go and, like I did this morning, immerse in a little river here. I'm in Costa Rica right now. And I didn't figure anything out mentally. All I did is immersed in that river and listened to what it sounded like from underneath the water. And then I came up and I saw like the sun streaming through the trees and like this shower of, maybe it was pollen or a little, I don't know, there was a shower of something just like coming through. And I was just noticing everything around me, and I felt different. So that is a signature of what I'm speaking of, the story of interbeing. Like, we become more whole the more we expand our relationships, because if we are relationship, if we are created and defined by relationship, then the more we expand our relationships, the more whole that we feel. And so this could be human relationships. And so the work could be about what is keeping me from authentic, intimate relating to the human beings around me? What's keeping it superficial and making me feel lonely and making me feel like I'm not fully here? And it could be relationships beyond the human world. So that's kind of where where this lens of interbeing can take me on a personal level. But then I also apply it to, you know, economics, technology. Like, what would all of these systems look like if they embodied and expressed this truth of interbeing?
That's so powerful. I mean, I have to say, and I very much advocate that this is an interconnected web of natural life that we're part of. And that's the basis of many First Nations way of thinking and operating. It's that deep innate connection with all that surrounds us and all that informs and teaches us and all that holds, provides, nourishes, nurtures, and shelters us. And this is what I believe connection is really about. And we have to feel that within. We have to amplify that deeper connection with all that exists around us, including the trees, the animals, the elements. You know, one of the things that I speak about is the fact that we've got a very famous lighthouse walk here where I live in the Byron Shire. It's beautiful. And I often see, because there's whale watching season, and I often see people just looking at the whales through a device. You know, they're not immersing themselves in that experience, that beauty that's presenting itself in that moment. And so Kelly Brogan, our mutual friend, what she said to me, she said that that is because we don't have practice to hold that beauty in our bodies. And I think, you know, that's a real testament to the direction in which humanity is due to evolve, is I guess what I'm saying. But you identify four really important pillars that allow you to live life well. And these pillars, you say, are the contemplation, action, grief, and celebration. But how do you implement these?
Where did you Where did I talk about contemplation, action, grief, and celebration?
It was in an interview that I watched that you did with our friend Dr. Edith Ubuntu Chan.
Okay, yeah, that really came up in the moment.
Well, maybe start off by telling us what you think are the important pillars to allow you to live life well. I mean, it could be just the one pillar that you want to focus on, but how do we implement the values that we have is, I guess, the bigger question.
Yeah. So the reason I said, you know, that kind of came up in the moment, it's like, I mean, I could probably reconstruct what I said, but that's not actually how I live life. You know, it's not like I have these pillars and these principles, and then I, you know, reason my way from those into here's how I make choices in life. The recognition of those comes kind of after the fact. And I've really gotten away from even this question of how to live a good life. What are the instructions? What are the 10 steps? You know, what are the 7 habits or what, like, I spent an hour or two talking this morning with some neighbors here who are just like so positive, and have such, to use a trite phrase, such good energy that, like, just spending time with this couple, I walk away knowing better how to live a good life. Could I put that into words? No, not necessarily, at least. Maybe I could. Because I'm, you know, talented with words, but it's not necessary because I received information from them that was not verbal and can't easily answer the mental question of how. Yet when that information comes in, which can come in through interacting with somebody who's carrying a lot of love or interacting with a place that carries a lot of beauty, then something in me changes. So the part of me that wants to know how, I've learned to relax that part a bit. And to kind of say, you already know how. Mm-hmm. It's a, it kind of comes from this anxiety or this desire to control things, you know, and this habit of, even a habit of authoritarianism, which we are inculcated with in our schooling, you know, in our childhood. I mean, our whole society is, and I say our, I mean, like pretty much any society that is civilized, any society that is hierarchical, any society that is run by punishments and rewards, and domestication. So maybe excluding some very traditional indigenous societies. But growing up in this society, we become conditioned to what I would call authoritarianism, which is looking to the authority for what do I do? What do I do? How do I do it? How do I be a good child? How do I get the good grade? How do I get the reward? How do I avoid the punishment? How do I do this? It's a surrender of the, you could say, the sovereignty, which knows what to do, just like an animal knows how to be a dog, like a dog knows how to be a dog. Like we know how to be a person, and to abdicate that knowledge to an external authority to tell you how to do it is quite tragic. And so anyway, that's a very long-winded way of, I mean, I'd be happy if you want to ask about contemplation or grief or celebration or anything like that. But I'm not going to like lay out the
I love that you don't have like your, you know, it's written in stone and that's your, you know, your your religion, if you know what I mean. But I actually really want to touch on rewards and punishment, what you just said, because I know you've said before that it's like a means of, I think the word was domestication, and I may be wrong about that word, but I heard you say that in my mind, I heard domestication anyways, but it was this overcoming of these animalistic wild impulses of a child and replacing these really deep desires that we have to please people, and that at the deepest level taps into, from my own experience, rejection and abandonment and fears and wanting acceptance and approval from, you know, authority. And that's also a really big fear for animals. I know I've got an animal too. And, you know, like the fear, the fear of an animal when, you know, he's about to be punished as well. I mean, you see that it's incredible to me that we still live in a time where the school system encourages that, rewards and punishment, and households still, you know, passed down more so generationally. But a child will do almost anything to receive that approval and acceptance. And I want to know, why is it, especially in the last few years, we've seen so many people bend over for you know, to authority, but it's more so that it's so painful, and it's the reward is also so, and correspondingly, it's also powerful in the other direction. Why is it that we live in this kind of Western society that is still very much in that space of rewards and punishment? Is it because we don't have that rite of passage into adulthood? I mean, what is the reason why we feel so overwhelmed by that?
There's a lot of reasons how this system of control that we've inherited came to be. But you were naming something very important there when you mentioned acceptance and abandonment, rejection and abandonment, which is the that's how we in this society override the natural impulses of children, by placing something that trumps all other desires on top of it, which is to be accepted by the parent. And ultimately that's also part of being accepted by the tribe, by being accepted by the society, but it starts with being accepted by the parent. And the primal mammalian fear is that you will be abandoned by your mother. It happens in nature, you know? Nature is cruel. If a mother animal is unable to care for her young, she will abandon the young. Or, you know, if the mother, you know, is injured or killed or something like that, you know, the mother doesn't come back. And that is a death sentence for the nursing babies. So this fear can be exploited through these gestures of abandonment that parents deploy in order to control their children, in order to get them to do what they want. And it can be like outright punishment, you know, physical punishment, or it can just be like this rejection, like this shaming, what's wrong with you? Turning away, yelling at the child, you know, that's very, very, it's very stressful for a child to experience that. And the child will do almost anything to get back in the parents' good graces. So the problem is that when the child is doing, let's take an extreme version of it, everything to either avoid punishment or gain approval, then the child never develops an internal authority. What do I actually want to do for other reasons besides avoiding punishment and getting approval? So that muscle of sensitivity to one's authentic desires becomes kind of frozen in one posture, and the sensitivity becomes blunted. You're only sensitive to one thing. And so this is going to be part, I'm actually constructing a course on parenting, that this is going to be one of the themes. You know, and so what happens then is that this conditioning then, at first it gets internalized, and you're always like trying to please the inner judge, and you're never good enough, you know, and you're always trying to control yourself through rejection and approval, which doesn't actually work. But some part of you, just like you rebel against the over-controlling parent, you rebel against the over-controlling inner judge. And so if you're trying to use that control technology of self-approval and self-rejection to make yourself stick with a diet or to stop indulging in an addiction or something like that, you know, you'll rebel and explode in a binge of some sort. And then that will become fuel for further self-rejection. So that's one thing that it does. And the other thing is that it makes us susceptible, vulnerable to the externalized parent, which is the authority in society. And so this is one reason why people are so vulnerable to authoritarianism and fascism and all of the means of social control that we've seen unfold in the last few years. There's more to it. There's also like the dimension of social conformity and mob morality that I've explored a lot in the Coronation book. But I think, I don't know, I think I've said enough for the moment on that topic.
And, you know, you talked about addiction, and we can't not talk about technology and the role that it's played, especially with the rewards and punishment model. It fits perfectly into that binge screening, into all of the ways in which especially children are being encouraged to enter an unnatural vortex to warp their attention, and really to they're paying for your attention, and there's a real deeper meaning for paying attention in that context. But also it's shifting that sort of power away from focusing on the present moment to what's available on the screen. And I'm not suggesting that you need to be, you know, turn off all your screens and never look at them, but there's just no discernment and there's no meaningful connection even online. It's just this ability to distract you from the boredom of being with yourself. And we know that, you know, we have to be quite brave to walk on the edge of transformation, and all children, you know, come into adulthood one way or another. But this is, it's a courageous attempt. You know, if you want to look at the recognition of a previous, I guess, way of identifying with yourself and your community through technology versus actually being present. And, you know, a lot of what you talk about is the economics, you know, the consumer culture, for example, where I live. I've noticed in the last few years, for one, is that people are slowing down. They're spending less time on screens, and so are the kids. I think they're cultivating deeper relationships and trying to engage more in the community and nature-based activities because it was stripped from them. And I think that we're entering a phase of technology that's being pushed on us by big tech companies, but I'm not sure that they're going to succeed. I'm not suggesting that they won't get far, but I think we've got to start moving into the direction of speaking into that. There are so many people that are excited about this whole, you know, looming technological singularity of AI. And one thing that you said once was that the AI believe that they can reduce every problem to data, and, you know, make decisions based on that, those quantitative methods. And I'm one to believe that you're not going to get quantity of life. You're going to get quality of life. You don't need data for that. But that these are certain solutions that are being framed in all these qualitative terms and pushing us into this agenda of being in a metaverse. And that's what the film Avatar was about. It was about getting out of your body and into this artificial reality. And I think people are seeing through it now. And I'd like to hear your perspective on AI, but also what you recognize as its limitations, because I'm sure there are many.
Okay. There's a few things there. So, and they're all actually all related. And it's really good to hear that you're observing a kind of a disengagement from the screens and from technology. And it's important to recognize that when people get addicted to their devices, their screens, their social media, it's not because they're bad and weak. It's because there's an unmet need that in the wisdom of the soul, they are seeking to meet in whatever, through whatever means are available. And if you are cast into a situation where you do not have access to community and intimate relationships, authentic relationships, and being embedded in an ecosystem and sourcing your food and your medicine from the plants and animals around you. And like, if you're not in a cultural setting where that's available, and instead you are being kept indoors all the time, then of course you're going to seek novelty and stimulation and connection through whatever means are available, which could be a screen. The promise of technology, this the implicit mythology of it, was that someday these devices will be able to equal or exceed the world that they substitute for. That, for example, virtual reality will become superior to regular reality because it's programmable, because it's controllable. You can take out all the bad things and the boring things and make it all exciting and real and vibrant, better than reality. And artificial intelligence the same way. Like we can make artificial intelligence that's superior to organic intelligence. So as you say, I think we are bumping up against the limitations of that. This is a phenomenon of addiction generally, where the object of the addiction doesn't actually meet or does not fully meet the need that drives the addiction. Social media, for example, never can fully meet the need for intimate connection. Sugar can never meet the need for sweetness in life. Gambling can never meet the need fully for excitement and challenging your boundaries. Pornography can never meet the need for intimacy. I mean, there's you know, all of these addictive substitutes never, they're a sham. And we're beginning to discover that. Like this is one of the big roadblocks that the metaverse has hit, is that people don't want to and cannot actually tolerate being in an avatar for very long. And so with artificial intelligence, this limitation takes the form, as you said, of the inability of the quantitative to fully simulate the qualitative. There's something always missing. So AI is very powerful and useful in dealing with matters that can be quantified. So if your input and your output can be reduced to data, and if what you are trying to achieve can be fully quantified, say for example, victory in a chess game, AI is very, very good at that. But and the conceit of the scientific worldview is that ultimately everything can be quantified. That's like one of the basic metaphysical assumptions of science. Everything can be quantified. If it's not measurable, it's not real. And that our progress in understanding means that we quantify things that had heretofore been purely qualitative, like, you know, intelligence or emotion, love. I mean, maybe we can quantify that in terms of a set of, you know, electromagnetic phenomena in the brain and hormones in the body and so forth. And now we know what love is. We've quantified it. And once we've quantified it, we can replicate it and maybe feed that in through the input-output device of your brain. But that whole way of conceiving of a brain is actually a transference of the computer. It's like a computer metaphor, and it's actually woefully insufficient to describe a brain. So and brains do a lot more than input and output quantity. So anyway, you know, there's like AI is extremely good at some things, and I think it's a useful tool. I'm not advocating that we discard any of the tools that we develop. But it's a question of recognizing what they are useful for and what they are not useful for. And we can get intoxicated because they're so good at some things that we think that maybe they're good for all things. And they therefore exceed their proper domain. And I think that that's true of technology in general. You know, maybe we've reached peak technology and we're starting to realize this is not ushering us into the paradise that it promised.
Absolutely. I mean, when you've got the World Economic Forum talking about algorithms taking over organisms. I mean, this is the extreme of what you're discussing. And I think most people probably don't understand the extremes of AI and this whole, you know, human 2.0, which is transhumanism, merging humans with technology. And most people who hear that will go, well, I think I'm going to draw the line in the sand of putting a Neuralink chip in my brain so that I can download, you know, Wikipedia. But there are technologies that are available that are, you know, it's something that Dr. Joseph Yee, when I did an interview with him, explained to me that he went on this AI platform and ChatGPT and basically asked for a download of 500 words on the benefits of, say, CBD oil, I think it was, and it just downloads it within seconds. And that's who they're suggesting we're going to be competing with in the future, is people that can just download information, that are studying topics, and they're getting all their information from this, you know, cloud or this, you know, metaverse of sorts. What do you say to people who want to stay connected with their human intelligence when the artificial intelligent world is trying to give you this understanding of you will understand and be connected to everything?
Yeah. I mean, we already kind of do that, you know, with an internet search. You know, the ChatGPT is just a faster version of that, really. And we've done that even before the internet, you know, like this merger of humans and technology has been going on for thousands of years. I mean, it was called the book, the encyclopedia. It took a little bit more time, but I don't think it was qualitatively any different. However, so, okay, you maybe have a Neuralink or something like that where you can instantaneously access that information and seem like a walking encyclopedia. In a sense, you are a walking encyclopedia of knowledge about CBD oil or non-ferrous metallurgy, you know, or C++ programming or whatever you want to access. But there are, again, some limitations and some things missing. For example, the chat AIs that can write you an essay or give you a, you know, 500 words of information, they have biases built into them. A lot of them will, you know, like somebody had to decide what information they are going to survey in order to deliver their product. And on one level, the bias is, well, maybe only mainstream sources. So like, have you ever looked up, say, UFOs on Wikipedia? Or homeopathy on Wikipedia, or pretty much anything controversial, it'll say, oh, it's pseudoscience and quackery, you know. And Wikipedia is more like kind of an extreme version of what the general official reality is. So one of the limitations on these AI chats or AI tools for accessing information, which would also be a limitation on the Neuralink, is that it gives you biased information, or it gives you a information from a certain realm, a certain reality. I wonder if reality and realm actually have a common origin. I think they do, the words. So AI is not going to be able to question its own premises in that way. So here's now a human being, like, could say, okay, yeah, I know the biases of this, and I'm going to take that into account. So here's a aspect of our intellectual sovereignty that we can hold and not surrender to the AI. So that's one level of bias, you know, like official information and dissident information. Like, what if you ask the ChatGPT about, you know, vaccine safety or something like that? What is it going to say? But then there's another level of even like, what kind of information can even go on the internet in the first place? And this is what we were talking about at the beginning. Like, what about the information that comes non-verbally? And what about our, like, aspects of our cognition that are not verbal? Like, how do we communicate that? Like, those things that we are very, very far from reducing to data. The experience of being in a field of love, can you download that on your Neuralink, you know, or on your computer? And actually, kind of, yes. Like, like a book, you know, to take an earlier technology, can carry a vibration of love. But it's not because it has sufficiently analyzed love. It's not translated love into semantic information, you know, symbols. It's in the way that the symbols were chosen. And I think that that possibility, I mean, you know, I write things on the internet. They're not books anymore. But, you know, they carry a vibration. And maybe even someone who programs a chat AI can infuse it with something. So I don't want to like say that these tools have no possibility of carrying something else on their vehicle that is beyond the analytic content. Anyway, I'm getting really into like some details here, but I guess I'm just again bringing up these limitations.
Yeah, it's really important. And you also wrote about it in The Ascent of Humanity. You said that we're being that we've been blinded by the promise of a techno-utopia. And that's a really great description, what you've just given, Charles, on the relationship to technology and proper applications of technology. I mean, that's not to say that there's no place for technology. It's just the limitations are pretty evident, and people need to understand that when they're making decisions on what they use and how they use it, I guess. But it comes down to a question for most people between good and evil. I think most people sort of, as you said, like it's not necessarily a good versus evil conversation, but for most people, when they think about AI, they either think about it in terms of good or they think about it in terms of evil. They'll go to those extremes. So we're conditioned, I guess, to look at the world and to look at technologies often in terms of good versus evil. It's I think what you say is biblical, right? So what do you see as actually the root of evil in the context of technology? So how extreme can it go when it is taken to the darker, you know, the darker side of this? Because people need to know. I mean, obviously we already know how good technology is. We're connecting right now on Zoom. But what most people don't want to look at, and I think that's been a real posture of the last few years, is that why would anyone do anything? Why would anyone release any type of technology, medical technology or big telco technology to harm us? It's just like there's this dissonance that Christiane Northrup recently said, Dr. Christiane Northrup on an interview, was like people just don't want to understand evil. And it's a really important part of our, I guess, of our maturity in a way. Is it like we can't not look at where these things can go in terms of its darker places. And I think it's important to mention.
Yeah. So artificial intelligence and information technology in general can be used in many ways. They can be used as instruments of domination and control. And they can be used as, you know, ways to communicate, and they can be used to bring transparency. You know, like what if we used all this surveillance technology to, instead of making the people transparent to the government, what if we used it to make the government transparent to the people? Like, what if everything that the government did was fully viewable by the public? Like the same technology could be used that way, and to some extent is. You know, with the ubiquity of you know, cell phones to record police violence and stuff. Like there's so the technology can be used in that way. So I don't think that, you know, we can reduce a question of technology to a question of good and evil. I think that it's a matter of appropriate use and context. And we have to then understand, what is this technology actually for? What is its proper purpose? And what does it serve when we use it in this way? And when we have a strong sense of a consensus of value and of direction and purpose, then we will know collectively what's an appropriate use of technology and what is not. Yeah, because
I think that's really valid. Yeah. And, you know, what we're talking about at the end of the day, what it comes down to for me at least, is the concept of change, you know, whether that's on the community level, the individual level, education, we've talked about technology, obviously. But I've heard you say that, you know, you can't fundamentally change one thing without changing everything else. And if you change one thing, everything else will change. That's the premise. So whether that's any of these topics that we've discussed today, come from the place that we need to understand that change doesn't happen without our participation in it. And it's important that whatever we're looking at, we have to decide on our willingness to participate in any of those things. And what I love about your perspective on it is the readiness. It's like that responsiveness to be ready. It's something that you don't make yourself do necessarily, but like you said in that example of speaking to some of the neighbors, you know, just before this interview, is like there's this incredible ability of people who have a certain resonant energy, a certain passion, a certain understanding of energy, I guess. Maybe they don't even have the understanding of energy. Maybe it just flows through them. I'm not even sure, to be honest. But this is the time where we're embracing or not embracing change. And it can come, you know, there is no doubt for me that whatever we're giving our attention to right now, even in this moment here, is about our readiness to grow or not. And we need to develop a level of trust in that uncertainty. Do you think that this is what's happening right now in society, is that people are far more willing to lean into that unknown space and actually have that conversation around change in their lives? Because I've noticed people around me that I never thought would be open to those conversations that are really, really open right now. And I'm noticing that there's a readiness that's available. And you have this beautiful way of offering people that sort of deeper place of spiritual understanding of readiness, I think is the best way I can put it, and that transition of readiness. And I'd love for you to talk into that.
Yeah. So I want to, before I say anything, I want to put a flag on the habit of seeing everything through the lens of approval, you know, self-approval, and to see, like, okay, to make readiness into something that either I've achieved or not achieved. And it's a virtue, and I have to do something to make myself ready. Like, to like live all of life as a chore, you know, as a competition, as an ordeal. Like, I want to just name that habit. Okay. So that I can talk about what readiness really is, which is a ripening. And I think that what you're seeing is true, that people are becoming ready, that this ripening is happening on a mass level, partly because the status quo reality is becoming more and more bleak, more and more lonely, like less and less tolerable, and partly because the alternative is revealing itself. Maybe not in ways that people could fully articulate, but there are like breakthroughs of, I call it the more beautiful world our hearts knew was possible, into the present world, where it reveals itself and says that the alternative to the status quo is not chaos and misery. But maybe you will go through some chaos and misery, but there is another side. There's something on the other side of that process of letting go, of transition, of dissolution. And it's beautiful. So there's, you know, it's like the, in childbirth, it's the stage when, I think this is the stage that we are at right now, when the cervix finally opens. The contractions have been going on a long time, but the cervix hasn't opened yet. And so you feel like this is getting less and less tolerable. This womb, it's bearing down on me from all directions. I mean, this is something that all of us, or almost all of us, have actually experienced. The commodious blissful room that could accommodate your growth endlessly, it has turned on you. It has become confining, and it's literally turned on you. It's like bearing down on you, you know, and there's no way out. Reality has become this hell. Like, there's no way out. But then when the cervix opens, you're like, oh, there's another world out there. This whole process is happening for a reason. And that light takes the form today of these little glimpses, these experiences, these communities, these places, these conversations, these groups that are showing what human life could be. And that is the draw that makes letting go a little less scary, that helps people not hold on quite so tightly. And so readiness, what you're speaking of readiness, you know, it's not like, how can I get ready? Like, it's another how-to question that I'm glad you didn't ask, because it's not a how-to. It's like, it's more of a process of gratitude for the process that has happened to you. And maybe the gratitude does accelerate the process. So the ripening comes, another way to say it is that we have completed the development that is possible within the boundaries of the story of separation and the society built on it. You know, and there was tremendous growth that happened in that story, in the story of domination and control. Like, we developed technology as we know it. And a myriad of human dramas played out, all of the dramas of patriarchy, you know, all of the dramas of abuse and the healing that comes from it, and the dramas of revolution. I mean, infinite dramas have played out in this container. And now maybe we have completed that storyline. And so we are now ready to move into the next act of the play.
Wow. My background's marketing, and I, one thing we all know as marketers, whether we admit it or not, is that how important and how necessary tension is in having that emotional connection to change. And we know this as mothers, those are listening. That's how we birth the new, and like what Charles just described in terms of this new way forward. And it can help us find the courage to move forward. I mean, that's, you know, change means tension. And if we do it right, it's released in that forward motion that leads to trust. And I think we're all on that path of, at least the viewers here and the listeners, of making what was that old obsolete standard. You know, we're here to offer something new in a parallel universe or a parallel society, if we want to call it that. And one of the things I often get asked, and I often ask other people, is how do we make that leap of faith? How do we take that leap of faith compared to, let's say, forcing anything? And what I really admire about your work, Charles, is that you help people understand that it's actually, yes, we've talked about tension, but there's also positive anticipation. And I liken that to standing on the edge, because I'm somebody that's always done work on the edge. And it's a very exhilarating feeling to stand on the edge of the unknown right before even leaping, I think, is the most exhilarating feeling. And yes, it's a feeling of I'm a bit scared, or I'm not sure, and all of those things. But there is that readiness that you keep coming back to, and those signs along the way that even though you haven't jumped, there is that feel. I think positive anticipation is actually a readiness. And along the way, you'll meet your tribe, and I very much feel I have that where I live. I live in a shire in a hinterland, and it's just, I'm very blessed. And I'm not sure that many people understand at this time this feeling of looking at your surrounding and not just yourself, because I believe change happens from the inside out, but collectively as a community, the possibilities that exist to pave a way forward together is some of the most important pieces of why I think we are here. And who would have predicted that, you know, these last few years would have created, in my personal experience, a web of tribe all around the world? And there is a certain magnetism that is driving, I think, this new way forward. And when we tap into that and we become a vessel for that, I believe we're doing divine work. And I tend to say to people that I'm here to play truth and dare. I think this is a classroom, not a courtroom. And that's something that a friend of mine, Vincent Tolman, said. And I think, you know, one of the things that we often hear, and you know, there are so many speakers about this, is that we're getting out of this I can't helplessness of this whole victim consciousness. And you clarify that for people. You know, you say that it's not necessarily, you know, it's not about, you know, making a choice to stay in this kind of world that we're in now, or moving into paving forward this next world. But you actually say this is part of our own education and part of our own breakthroughs in our own helplessness. And we have been molded to some degree, most of us, I would say, through that rewards and punishment model. But I feel like what you've just said, that birthing, where, you know, the contraction, I can relate to it so well as a woman that's given birth, to push through that tension and to birth into that space of love and unity. And we still need tension for love and unity. Like the idea that we can sing Kumbaya and everything just kind of, you know, just solves itself isn't really where I stand. But you really do embody that whole sovereignty and authority, where I'm of the same opinion. Like, I'm not really a believer of petitioning someone to change the world so I feel better in it. It's that inside out change, and without the permission and approval to do so, it's just to do it. So what do you say to people who are taking a great leap of faith today?
Definitely connect with the image of standing on a precipice, you know, and the positive anticipation you spoke of, and also the fear too, and the hesitancy. And that's not the enemy either. The unreadiness is not an enemy to be overcome and dominated. It's a stance of trust, where you trust yourself to know when the moment is. And you say, when the moment comes to jump, I will know it and I will jump. And I know that is true of myself. The naysaying voice is like, well, you should have jumped already and you haven't. What's wrong with you? And you can offer a different story, which is that it wasn't time. And now it's time, or it's almost time. Oh, almost time. You're always putting it off into the future. You're just afraid. No. I will know when it's time, and I will do it. I am brave. And so to find the part of yourself that knows that that is true. And then by connecting with the part that knows that it's true, then it becomes true. It's a act of prophecy. But you can't just say it as a mantra. You have to actually find the part that for which it is true.
Oh, I love
and
that.
Then, yeah, and then you will jump when the time comes to jump, and you won't jump too early. Yeah, you'll know. You'll know.
And the brilliant thing is, once you jump, there's another edge to jump later anyway. So there's always another jump after the jump. It's not the one jump in your life. It's recognizing that you'll come to the edge many times. And mm-hmm. you just get more comfortable with jumping, is my experience, I think. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like one of the reasons, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we're sort of missing that transition or that leap is from that the lack of initiation of a child into a community, into adulthood. And we just touched on it very, very briefly before, but that's something that's held by a community. It's not the responsibility of just the child, but it's held by a community. And the world that we are leaping towards doesn't necessarily exist yet. Potentially it does, but doesn't necessarily exist yet. How do we help and you said you're doing a course on this. How do we help educate our children, and especially into a society that doesn't exist yet?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we need to do, is to educate them into a society, or into a future, into a new future And not into the old future, which is never going to happen anyway, at least if we have any say about it. And so there's a lot of, you know, programs that we carry of, well, you know, I have to educate my child to do well in school so that he can get a job in the old system that isn't going to be there anymore, you know, but it can be scary for a parent to like encourage the child not to go to college, you know. Maybe take a permaculture design course instead, or maybe, you know, what do you really want to do? What do you know to do? Yeah. And as for initiation, you know, initiation is really a community function. So it doesn't really work to just send your kid off to some rite of passage thing, you know, some summer camp thing. When that has not been held throughout their childhood and they've not seen examples of people going and coming back from that and being treated differently by everybody around them, in order to be a man or a woman, to know yourself as a man or a woman, as a mature adult, you have to actually be held that way by others. Otherwise, you're always fighting them. They're still seeing you as a child. And then what is an adult? Like, what is a mature human being? What does that actually mean? Our society doesn't have much of an answer for that. But the answer in the story of Interbeing is that a mature adult is somebody who is turned their gifts toward something beyond themselves, toward the furtherance of life, and beauty. And meaning, you know. So an adult is not somebody who can stand on their own 2 feet and make a living. That's a very tiny part of it. It's somebody who's actually contributing to the tribe in the fullness of their gift. So because the gifts, you develop them in childhood in play, but at some point you're preparing them for their sacred purpose. So an initiation, and there's many kinds of initiation into life, but I think what you were talking about is an initiation into adulthood. It has something to do with that. And so, you know, we don't have a perfect rite of passage available to us because it's not something that you can design it perfectly. It requires a whole society around you to hold it. So all we can do is take steps toward that and bootstrap ourselves into a future that does not exist yet, but that in some sense, as you were saying, does exist. It exists, you know, as a potentiality. It exists as something that we can actually tap into and draw from as it creates itself through us. It's being born through us. And so we just need to be attuned to the opportunities to birth it, to bring it into being, and to prepare, to recognize those opportunities and to learn to ask when we face a choice, okay, is that in service to a more beautiful world? Or is it a step in the other direction?
Oh, absolutely. And I love what you talked about, the gift and giving, you know, that this is an opportunity to, for us, you know, set an example, but also to initiate our children into doing things that matter, that, you know, in one's own perception actually matters, and to receive those gifts that matter and that are of service. You know, you say that on some level, all of us have descended into this world of trouble and turmoil for a reason, and to uplift that world. And I think that's the greatest act of service. You know, when I heard you say that we are here as emissaries, which for those that don't know what that is, that's a special, someone that's on a special mission of the future. How do we know that something more beautiful than what currently exists is possible?
We know it because we've seen it. Well, or what we've, yeah, we know it because that's where we come from. That's our home. And the glimpses that we get of it just are reminders that reconnect us with the place that we came from and the place where we're going.
I really just want people to sit with that, because it's such, that's, I mean, part of why we call this show the We Know Show is because we can't, that's part of knowing where our greatest gift of biology is, our intuition, and that connects us with what we know. On without all the reasons, without all the fear of punishment, and without all the justification, it's that innate ability to know something at your core. And I absolutely, in my core, know, Charles, that we come from that place of knowing that a more beautiful future, a more graceful, connected, natural way of being is possible. And I think that's exactly why we are here. And, you know, we, I believe, are brave souls to come here and to stand on that edge of transformation and to have the courage and to recognize that these previous endeavors are a past their due date. We also recognize how precious our children are. And it's the greatest gift, I think, for me being here is having the role of many roles, but primarily my role as a mother. And you say that's a vehicle of life to continue. And it also is something, the knowledge of that keeps us very honest and brave. And I have to say that your work, Charles, has definitely given me a lot of courage and helped me sense my bravery and pushed me to, not you personally, but the context of what we've talked about today has pushed me to my bravery. I'd love for you to give our audience your final words of wisdom on the next few years, what we're about to witness and what you're feeling into, especially of late.
Yeah. I have a feeling that things are turning around right now. You know, they talk about an inflection point, which is a term from mathematics, actually. So you could have a curve that it's still, like, say, descending, right? But an inflection point is where, say, a higher derivative of the curve has changed sign. So in other words, whereas the curve had been convex, now it's concave, like the descent is slowing and it's going to bottom out and turn around. And that is already baked into the future, you know? So basically, on the superficial level, we are very likely going to see things get worse as the stories that have, the dramas that have been put in place get played out to their extreme. However, the core of our system, which is our consciousness, which is our mythology, that is changing. And without that core, the superficial structures will get more and more brittle. No one really believes in them anymore. No one believes in the story anymore. No one believes in the system anymore. No one's really, or almost no one, is really that excited to, you know, implant chips inside themselves. No one really believes that the metaverse is going to usher in utopia. Like, and like, you know, there's like this half-heartedness about the ambitions that once motivated us. Like when I was a kid, you know, I mean, there was just no doubt science was going to fix every problem and we were going to go off into space and robot servants and all that. Like, we don't believe in the story anymore. And the experience of being human, the consciousness that was at the core of those stories has shifted. We haven't seen that shift play out in our systems. We still live in the legacy of an old consciousness. And in the next few years, that legacy may take on even more exaggerated forms. As it's like a soap bubble that gets bigger and bigger. But as it does, the membrane gets thinner and thinner until one day it pops. And we realize how insubstantial it ever was. Just like a little drop of soapy water. So right now it seems like, you know, as dark and as unstoppable the whole technological program, the totalitarian program, like the, you know, medical totalitarianism, like all this stuff, like the, you know, the World Economic Forum and all this kind of, you know, it seems like this juggernaut that is getting more and more powerful. But that's just a superficial level. Not even its administrators really believe in it anymore. Even the people at the helm are losing faith and going through the motions and feeling trapped in their roles. I know this because, you know, sometimes I run into these people. Like, I know that they're like people in the U.S. government, like high-ranking military, senators, people like that, governors who are like sitting in ayahuasca circles. You know, like this is happening globally. And then they go back to the office and they're, what are they going to do? How, it's the same problem that any of us have. Like, how do you integrate this? So what's happening is that the hold of the ideologies, the narratives, the systems, they're weakening. And the core, which is ourselves or our consciousness, it's hollowing out. And in that empty space, that's where the new world is being born. So my prediction for the next few years is there's going to be maybe kind of an extreme playing out of these legacy stories before the soap bubble pops. And it may not be like a dramatic collapse, but it's going to be, and I don't know, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years from now. Yeah. And anytime you try to make a prediction and fix it into linear time, you're going to be wrong. Okay. So I'll just say that. But let's say as a poetic prediction of 5 years, okay, what does that mean in your psyche? We're going to have the experience of it has shifted. It is different now. I can hardly believe it, but let us believe it. But we have some bumpy territory to go, I think, before that shift.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that you talk about is that we're given this world, the word you use is with all its imperfections, and we're given each other with all our imperfections and all those inner conflicts and the outer conflicts that are taking place and all the traumas that are definitely showing itself right now. And we're actually given all these things, as you say, to make beauty from. And that's something that resonates with me deeply, because I've seen, especially in the last years, some of the most incredible work and some of the most incredible empowerment of humanity that I've ever seen in my lifetime. And I think one of the ways, and I know that this is something you talk about, is it comes down to the kindness, you know, having that friendship with oneself throughout the next whatever years it will be, but just to continue that friendship with oneself. If there's anything that I've really recognized, is there are more and more people having a friendship with themselves and their sovereignty. And I think that that translates into every single thing that you'll do in life. And you're a huge advocate for that. And I thank you. I thank you so deeply for your voice and your word. It's so powerful. And we know that, you know, in the times that we're living in, to have stood in your sovereignty and to use your voice is not a small, it's not a small thing. That's a thing to have done at the edge. And I'm grateful to you, Charles, for being on the show, on the We Know show, for sharing your incredible wisdom. And for our audience that's listening, where can they find more of your work, Charles? Where can they follow and support you?
Most of my new stuff right now I put on Substack. So charleseisenstein.substack.
Great. Yeah. And we'll put all the links that are available on our show notes for this episode. For now, thank you so much, Charles, for this incredible interview. And for everybody listening, I will see you on the next episode of The We Know Show. Bye, everyone.
There you have it. Yes, technology does bring a sense of connection, but now you know there is another side behind the marketing curtain. So what can you do? Stay connected with us at wearenotsam.com. You can also find us on Instagram or Telegram at wearenotsam and subscribe to our channel. But most importantly, find your tribe and spread the word. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of The We Know Show. Whilst The We Know Show presenters endeavour to provide accurate and helpful information to their listeners, these podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice. You should always seek the advice from a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of The We Know Show podcasts.